thank you very much for coming along. My name's Andrew Lee, and we're here in conversation, of course, with Claire Wright, author of Forgotten Rebels of Eureka. Can I, of course, begin by acknowledging we're meeting on traditional lands of the Ngunnawal people and pay my respects to their elders past and present. I'm just outside my electorate, so I had to get a visa from Gabe Rotman to come south side, but fortunately that's been granted. What we're going to do tonight is I'll have a bit of a Q&A with Claire for maybe half an hour, 40 minutes or so, and then throw it open for a broader conversation. There is plenty of cheese, plenty of wine, courtesy of the wonderful Paper Chain folks, so feel free to jump up and grab a glass at any moment in the evening. So Claire, I have about 3 hours worth of questions for this fascinating book, but I thought maybe because it is grounded in these wonderful stories, we should go to that great quote that you have at the front of your book, and which I also happen to have on my office fridge. Well-behaved women rarely make history. Do you want to tell us a bit of the story of a couple of your favourite women, Catherine Bentley and Sarah Hamner?
What I really want to know is why you have that on your office fridge. Sorry, wrong.
We can talk about that.
Fascinated. Yeah, well, I guess one of the things that was so fascinating about delving into the lives of these women and discovering them in the archives was recognising that these were women who were not behaving in ways that were considered to be, that we might consider to be appropriate ways for women to behaving, particularly when the ideology at the time was that women would be civilising influences. So that is always the notion that's given about what women would bring to this hyper-masculine society in Victoria. So it was Carolyn Chisholm's idea, and certainly it was Governor Hotham's idea, and it had been Governor Latrobe's idea. And it really goes right back to the beginning, that when you have a society that's predominantly male, that what bringing women would do would be to act as agents of civilization, that they would tame men's wilder instincts, that they would make good homes, that they would make calmer citizens. But actually what I was finding was that they were fanning the flames of dissent and rebellion. So they personally were acting in rebellious ways, but they were also fanning these wider communal rebellions. And to me that was just a fascinating aspect of the research. So we have a woman like Sarah Hanmer, who was running a theatre in Ballarat at the time. She was a single woman who had come out from England. She was a single mother. She had had this child, I discovered, after doing all sorts of, going down all sorts of rabbit holes and doing really intense kind of who do you think you are kind of research of trying to find where she'd come from and what her life had been like before she was here. She had had this baby when she was 14. And she was an actress in England, and she'd clearly gone to the diggings in at the Californian Gold Rush. And then she had gone back to England, and she appears to have married somebody who was not the father of her child. But he's nowhere to be seen by the time she comes out to Victoria. And Sarah did what a great number of these women did, I discovered, that maybe the first ill-behaved thing that they did was that they signed on to the ship at a certain age, and by the time they'd made the 3-month journey out to Australia and got off the ship, lo and behold, they dropped about 6 years of their age. So, you know, this isn't a day before passports and any other kind of identity papers, and all they had to do was say to the immigration officer, you know, their name and where they were from, and I'm 24. And so that becomes recorded. So it's not until some pesky historian comes along later on and gets a death certificate and matches it against the shipping records that you go, something's wrong with this picture, and then you can actually work out how old she was. So she comes out to Ballarat. She starts a theatre, the Adelphi Theatre, and it becomes a huge success. She's incredibly entrepreneurial as this theatre manager. She puts on her own plays. She acts in them. Her daughter Julia, also who's 12, also acts in them, and she becomes very wealthy. She's the darling of the diggers. They love her, and she's very well respected. And one of the things that was absolutely fascinating for me to find out was I came across a list of the chief donors to the Diggers Fund. So they had something called the Diggers Defence Fund by the time the movement really amps up to in the last months of 1854. And it was like an account book showing how much had been donated by various members of Ballarat Society. And there Sarah Hammer is, top of the list. She gave more money to this than anybody. So she really bankrolled the Diggers movement. And her hotel, the Adelphi Theatre, was also used as the headquarters for the Ballarat Reform League as well, and particularly the Americans gathered there. The Germans gathered at a different hotel, and the Jews gathered at a different hotel, and Sarah's was particularly used by the Americans, and which led me actually for a time to believe that she was American, but that's not the case. She was Scots-Irish. And her theatre was actually going to be used for a meeting on the 3rd of December at 2 p.m. to decide what the diggers were going to do next. But obviously it never got to that point because in the dead of night the massacre happened. So she's just one of the many women I discovered who were acting in ways which did not please the government of the time.
And then Catherine Bentley, quite a different character. Tell us about Catherine.
Catherine was a different character. She was Scots Irish Protestant. She came over from Sligo in 1852. She was single. She came with her sister. She was 22 when she arrived. She clearly had some education and quite a lot of ambition. And when she arrived, she and her sister both married quite quickly, which I discovered was indeed a pattern of this immigrant generation, and quickly became pregnant, started a family, and pretty soon the man she had married, James Bentley, who was an ex-convict, he had already been in the colony for a long time, he was English, he had a confectioner's business, but realised that the smart money was on alcohol. Particularly on the diggings of the gold fields, which had been illegal to sell alcohol on the diggings. In the township of Ballarat, or in Bendigo, for example, you could get a licence, but on the whole, where the diggings population were, it was illegal. Which wasn't to say there wasn't a lot of alcohol. The place was awash with alcohol, but it was being sold through sly grogs, most of which were run by women. And then the government changed its mind because there were so many complaints about the corruption that was involved with police taking hush money that they decided to start giving out licences. And who was at the top of the queue for the first licence for the Ballarat diggings was James and Catherine Bentley. So they got, which is basically a licence to print money. And they built this huge hotel. It was the absolute landmark building at East Ballarat. It was on a hill which quickly became known as Bentley's Hill. And everything, like if you look at the Ballarat Times, if there was any shop that was going to be wanting to, you know, there weren't any streets necessarily that you could give addresses for, but if they wanted to give their location, they would say just east of Bentley's Hill, or, you know, in the lee of Bentley's Hotel. It was an absolute landmark. It was made of wood, it had chandeliers, it was painted gold and vermilion, for God's sake. They really were making a statement about their level of wealth and affluence and their position in society. And then Catherine, who was at this time 7 months pregnant with their second child, their first one was 2 years old, her life just goes horribly wrong because a miner is killed outside the Eureka Hotel one night in early October. James Bentley is fingered for the crime. The local magistrates exonerate him. The people feel this is the last straw of judicial injustice that they can handle. They hold a protest meeting in front of the hotel that turns into a riot, and the hotel is burnt to the ground in a matter of minutes, basically. And one of the most extraordinary things that I found, I can still remember the day when I finally got to a document, you know, very randomly, that was a man recounting his story of being the one who threw Catherine Bentley out of the top floor window to the crowd below. Now, this is a crowd that's baying for the blood of the Bentleys. Her husband has already gotten on a horse and escaped to the government camp, and she's clearly left in the burning hotel, which the police, who had been in charge of the hotel, have now abandoned. And she's upstairs with her toddler and her pregnant belly, and she gets chucked out the window and caught by the crowd below. I'm not sure where she went from then, but pretty soon she's in custody. She goes to Melbourne. There's another trial in front of Redmond Barry, who a few years later hangs Ned Kelly. And she was tried for the murder of James Scobie as well. And she was 8 months pregnant when she's in the dock. They gave her a chair to sit on. It was the one concession that was made. Well, maybe actually two concessions, because she was exonerated of the crime. Her husband went to jail. Two other men went to jail for that crime. So she now had no breadwinner, no home. The hotel was actually built on land to which she owned the preemptive title. I've seen the title document. She signed it in her hand. James Bentley was illiterate. And she then petitioned the government for years for compensation for the burning down of her hotel. £30,000 she claimed, a huge amount of money at the time. She still has a descendant today who has been for the last 20 years trying to get that compensation for the government. He's now saying it's worth $2 million. He's taken the case to The Hague, believe it or not. But he is carrying on a kind of fury that Catherine herself felt to the end of her days. She was still trying to tell the story from her perspective right up until the day shortly before she died. There was a document that I discovered that is her, in her writing, on the back of a petition, a printed petition for her husband's freedom that was signed by the shopkeepers of Ballarat at the time and other publicans and business people. She had written what she felt happened on the night of Scobie's murder. And that had come down as a family document that was given to me by the family. It's now in the Gold Museum in Ballarat. So I felt a particular connection to Catherine Bentley, because I felt like she was reaching out across the centuries to say, someone please tell my story, you know, believe me. I don't know whether I believe her version of events, but I do believe that she was a woman who cried out for justice. And if she had have been on the miners' side, rather than lumped in as being one of the villains of the Eureka story, which is how the Bentleys have always been portrayed, I do believe that if she had have been put in the miners' side, she would have been on the right side of history. She showed all of the values that have been considered to have, you know, demonstrate the spirit of Eureka. But she was one of Eureka's victims.
Do you think you're attracted to Catherine in part because she joins your previous work and your future work, your book on women publicans and your book to come on the women and the Kelly story?
It was certainly Catherine who led me to Eureka, because I had in my previous work, which was about the history of female publicans in Australia, and that book was published as Beyond the Ladies' Lounge, I had been tracing women. Well, one of my arguments in that was that female publicans had always been at the epicentre of Australian history and the momentous events in Australia's history, because so many of them do occur in hotels, around hotels, in places where alcohol is freely in. It's quite a theme in Australian history. You know, Frank's written a wonderful book about the way that sex and sexual activity can be seen as a kind of prism through which you can view other aspects of Australian history. Alcohol is one that you definitely can do that through as well. So I had found accounts of the burning of the Eureka Hotel, and I found one reference to Mrs. Bentley in a secondary source, and that was my kind of aha moment. And then I tried to find something about her, couldn't in any of the secondary material, didn't have the time at that stage to do the intense primary research that's required. So I kind of put Catherine Bentley, I didn't know her name then, I put Mrs. Bentley to one side and vowed I'd return and find out more about her. And I did, through an act of almost complete, like, you know, archive stalking. I felt like I was obsessed with this woman. And I discovered all sorts of other things about her life after. James Bentley ended up committing suicide a few years later, funnily enough, on Ballarat Street in Melbourne. and topped himself on laudanum. And Catherine says at his inquest he had never been right in the head since the events at Ballarat. And then that note that I was just describing, that she wrote about her version of what happened on the night that Scobie died, she wrote that on the anniversary of her husband's death over 20 years later. Mm. So you can sort of see the way that these things burn into people's consciousness. And so, yes, it did come out of that research, and yes, it does lead on to the next project that, I'm working on, which is about the women in the Ned Kelly story and how that iconic event can be reconfigured if we add the women back in who were actually there, who are an authentic part of the story. So rather than seeing the Kellys as a Kelly gang, which automatically masculinizes the story, if we see them as a Kelly family, which they most certainly were, it just it doesn't take anything away from the men who are the actors. It just spreads the roles out more and makes them perhaps less of the exclusive protagonists, and expands our cast a bit more. And it also helps us, and I think this is really what happens with the Eureka story, it helps us understand the motivations of those men a lot more if we put them in relation to the women who were part of their lives and who were there. So we can see these miners, these gold diggers, not just as rugged individuals out on the frontier, but as husbands and fathers. And as anybody in the room who is a husband and a father knows, the way that you might understand what you're doing here on this earth, what your sense of freedom, your sense of rights, your sense of purpose is shaped by those relationships as much as it is shaped by larger ideals of liberty or democracy. And so it's about the interplay between those daily domestic aspects of your day-to-day relationship to the people around you, to your ambitions, to your expectations, and those wider notions of the body politic and the government. And that's what I think putting women back into the story does. It doesn't take anything away from the men. It actually makes their story richer and humanises them.
So, I mean, much of what you do, in some sense, seems to be taking two-dimensional stories and drawing out the third dimension in it. But I have to go to something that I particularly loved as an economist, which is your account of what happens when women got off the boat in Melbourne in a place where the gender ratio was strongly in their favour. And economists, of course, really like to think about relative prices. So talk us through what happens in a society where men significantly outnumber women, the monetary offers that are made to wed, and also something about what that does to the household division of labour.
Well, the last thing I would ever want to characterise myself in as is an economist or an economic historian, but I do use the term the marriage market because that's clearly what these women felt that they were placing themselves into, and that their stakes in the marriage market had radically increased since they arrived in a place where suddenly there was not gender parity. And they had an enormous amount of power. They had an enormous amount of bargaining power and pulling power. I guess that's competition, Mr. Economist. And so there's this wonderful illustration, which we reproduce beautifully in the book, that was actually on the front of London Punch. So it was a way that this was being represented back in England about... both as a way to encourage women, I think, to come to the gold diggings, but also it reflects male anxieties at the time. And there's many others that back that up, that sense of male anxiety. In this illustration, the women are arriving at the docks in Melbourne, and there's a whole bunch of men who have come down to greet them. And the expression was, in search of wives and servants. And these women are saying... no thanks. I think I'll go for another offer Thanks very much. So the line in the book is fiddle-dee-dee, so bother your house in the public line and your £100. Like, clearly you're going to have to make me a better offer than that. And the men standing on the docks have these looks of vexation and confusion, and the women have these kind of haughty expressions of kind of dignity, but self-possession, you know. So suddenly the idea of being a self-governing colony, which of course Victoria had only recently reached its own political status as a self-governing colony, this suddenly was now a place where women could be self-governing. They had far more choices than they'd ever had before, and they could afford to hold back, to wait, and many of them did do that, and they went to the goldfields on their own. They went as single women to the goldfields, where their labour was highly in demand because there was this population of largely single, young, peripatetic men. And to be a woman and to have domestic skills was an advantage on the market. It was a commodity that you could sell, and sell it they did. So suddenly the women who were really making the money were ones who were doing the washing, so washerwomen. Get terribly rich. Women who were providing food and victuals, the sly grog sellers, boarding house keepers, actresses, prostitutes. But, you know, prostitutes are the ones that we might think are, they're the go-to in our mind of what happens on a Wild West frontier in terms of women. But actually, what I came across in the literature was they're really kind of, they're acknowledged that they're there, but a lot more of the focus is on these other women who are performing these other tasks. It's kind of taken for granted that there's going to be a handful of prostitutes that are going to be servicing the miners, but not just the miners, the military as well. There's actually a particular prostitutes camp that were known to service the government officials and the military who were there. But it's actually this wider labour pool of women who suddenly could command prices they'd never seen before, and they're writing home. You know, I found lots of letters where they're writing home just begging their sisters, their aunts to come out. Come out. Don't be a dill. Don't stay there. Come out. You'll be able to get good wages. You'll find a man who will respect you, and that you can get suddenly a wife. There's a great line. I wish I could quote it off the top of my head. But you're basically saying you'll be treated better here than you ever were at home, because suddenly you have something of value to give, to sell, effectively. And that was your labour.
So what you've done, in some sense, is to round it out what I thought of as a kind of egalitarian view of this period in Victoria as being a working man's paradise, to being also a period in which women are treated with a greater sense of equality than most parts of the globe in the 1850s. But then also you have this discussion about the role of luck, the notion that being in the goldfields was so desperately hard because you could work a 12-hour day digging deep into the ground and find nothing while the person next to you did the same thing and struck it lucky. Talk to us about the tension between the lottery view and the egalitarian view.
And certainly it was the expression that the miners used all the time, that it's a lottery, the digging is a lottery. And part of the reason it was a lottery was because of the geological basis of mining, so in particularly in Ballarat. So by the time most of these immigrants who are around at this particular point in 1854 get there, most of the shallow alluvial gold has gone already. So gold is found in Ballarat in August 1851. The reports start going back to England in 1852. It takes, you know, roughly 6 months to a year for communications to happen. This is pre-telegraph, so it's 3 months there, 3 months back, you know. So there's a six-month turnaround at the minimum of any news. So by the time the word gets out and gets back that this is the place, you can pick up lumps of gold from the street, you can just, you know, you can shovel it up, it's child's play. All these expressions are going back. And significantly, and these are the ones that I was really honing in on, the fact that, and the idea that men could suddenly become providers, the providers they'd always wanted to be, and they could reach a sense of, this expression's used all the time, a manly self-regard. They could regain a manly self-regard that they'd lost in England in the under the yoke of hierarchy, is essentially the way that it's expressed. But by the time the majority of these immigrants get here, in late 1852, early 1853, that early phase of shallow alluvial, the picking it up in handfuls, is gone. And in Ballarat in particular, most of the gold is now found in deep leads, which run in these ancient riverbeds. And so the riverbed will go like this, but you can't see it because it's buried under the ground, 100 feet under the ground, 150 feet in some places. So by this stage, it's going to require teams of men generally to buy their license, which they have to pay every month, that pay the license fee, whether they get gold or not. This becomes obviously an enormous irritant because it's essentially a poll tax. And as we know from history, nobody likes a poll tax. And so they dig a shaft. So one team could start. So, okay, here's ancient riverbed. One team could dig a shaft here, and one team digs a shaft here, and one team digs a shaft here. And you're 150 feet down, and it can take 6 to 9 months to get that deep, and you're pulling it out every day, paying your license fee every month. Several families now dependent on what comes out of the ground there because you've got teams working together. And this one strikes it one day. These two are bereft of any gold. That's the lottery that's involved in it, just from the sheer luck of having been the one that picked that spot. And because you can't know where the twists and turns are going to be. So that's the element that they all say, that the thing that you need is hard work, but actually what it comes down to is an enormous amount of luck. And what these miners were particularly finding in 1854 is that the clash between their expectations and the reality of what they found on the ground is just, this is just the minefield that happens. They thought they were going to achieve one kind of life, and they feel ripped off. They feel entitled to this manly self-regard. They feel like they've been sold a pup. And at the same time, they're being beaten down by the government. They're being oppressed in all sorts of ways, particularly in the way this license fee is collected. And it comes back to the previous point, the women are doing quite well for themselves. So in all of this 6 to 9 months that the men are digging, it's the women who are largely being the breadwinners, who are feeding the families. And so they've got this newfound economic power in the relationship, within the sexual dynamic, and the men are feeling completely shit-ass about themselves because they're not getting any gold, they haven't achieved this independence they thought they were going to have, they can't get any land, they can't afford to go home, and they've now saddled up and starting new families because most of them were young, and as we were discussing before, there was this extraordinary baby boom in Ballarat over this year. I was just saying to Andrew before, I was crunching the numbers earlier, and in 1854, in those 12 months, there are 6,000 babies. The proportion of the children goes up by 6,000 in Ballarat. And that works out to be about 14 babies a day being born. And it totally reimagines your sense of what this gold diggings are. If you think about that amount of life being produced and all those men having all those mouths to feed and not being able to do it. And these are some of the things that I think set up the tensions that later start to spill over in those last months.
Well, let's talk about the results of those tensions. I mean, you quote Geoffrey Blainey's line that Eureka is like a neon sign flashing on and off with different messages for all of us. I moved a motion in Parliament last year on Eureka, and it exactly fitted that story. So all the people on the Labor side stood up and talked about how this was the initial stirrings of the Republican movement, a great egalitarian cause with terrific ethnic diversity. And my Liberal and National colleagues stood up and talked about how this was a tax revolt by small business owners against oppressive government. What do you see? Eureka as meaning for you, and what has your book added to the messages that flash from the neon sign?
Yeah. What I have tried to do, I don't think my book is apolitical, but I haven't taken a line on that stand. What I've tried to do is to rehumanise this landscape. So, for example, one of the things that I do that is unusual in the Eureka literature is to also give voice and try to put some flesh and bone on the people who were in the government camp, the soldiers and the police and the officials who were there. They also had wives and children with them. One of my main characters is Maggie Johnson, who is a young woman who comes out. She's the fiancée of James Johnson, who is the assistant gold commissioner at Ballarat. She arrives on the off the boat in August 1854, and immediately they go out to Ballarat. She clearly gets pregnant on the road out to Ballarat because dutifully, actually it's a bit, it comes a bit early, I think, precipitated by the events in Eureka. She her first child is born prematurely. But she is at the government camp during this time, and fortunately she's kept a diary, and it's very scanty, but she is there at the time. And if I can digress from your very excellent question, which I'll get back to in a minute, this is how close this story is to us, how we can reach out and touch this history. The reason I'm aware of this diary is because Maggie Johnson's granddaughter is still alive today. She lives in Sydney. And that's because Maggie and James Johnson went on to have 15 children, as these people did in the time. The last of their children didn't get married and have children of his own until his late 40s. She's the only child that he had. So she's in her 80s and is the grandchild of Maggie Johnson. And she has this family diary, which is now donated to the State Library of Victoria. And so I've also tried to give a kind of context for the motivation of the people who were in the camp, the men who were in the camp, what they were feeling, why they had so much pent-up frustration on the morning that it was unleashed on the miners and the women and children who were behind the barricades at Eureka. And so I suppose what I've tried to do in rehumanising this landscape is to make the story more socially inclusive. Mm. Whether you're on the tax revolt side or whether you're on the birthplace of Australian democracy, you know, this is the start of the Australian legend side, I think the story benefits from speaking to more of us. It certainly benefits from being more historically authentic than it has ever been before. So what I've tried to do is strip away the mythology. The best way to do that is not to read secondary accounts. Mm-hmm. And to go straight back to the archives. It's why it's taken me 10 years to write the book, because it's just the long, hard slog of archival research. And it's retelling the story from the ground up. I've tried to put it in the voices of the people as much as possible so that my voice becomes one, almost like the kind of, I don't know, the narrator or something. You can tell me whether you think that was an effective strategy. But I wanted to rebuild the story from the ground up, from the perspective of the people who were there, and most importantly, from the perspective of all of the people who were there. So I suppose if I've got a neon sign flashing, which is Jeffrey Blaney's, you know, code for agenda, it's to make this a story that is more accessible and more relevant and more inclusive of our diverse Australian society today, which happens to include 50% of the population who are women. And so I'm not telling the story of a marginal group because women are not marginal. We keep having to kind of remind people of the fact that women are not marginal. And so I think that girls who are being educated in Australian schools today are entitled to see themselves in this story. I think they're entitled to look back to their history for a sense of who they might be in the future, who their role models might be, what their sense of action or agency is. And it's why I use a line early in the book which is one reviewer in the Monthly has actually taken me to task on this line. But I say one of the things, one of the beauties of the Eureka story, but also its terror, is that the story is both politically correct and historically true. And what I meant by that was that social inclusiveness could now be seen as being like, black armband history or something. That is a politically correct notion to be socially inclusive. But it also, it's not to imply that I had to make anything up in order for that to be so, for it to speak to a wider, more contemporary audience for whom gender equality should just be a given. So that there's more access and equity within this story. And the story has all of that. It contains it within itself. It's not fabricated.
Yes.
It's true. And that's why it's a great story.
So I have a long list of questions still to ask. We haven't even touched on sea voyages and sewing of the flag and the influence on the suffragettes, but I do want to open it up to people here and allow people to ask any questions of Claire you'd like to before we wrap up. Are there any questions from the impressively credentialed crowd?
I'd like to ask what happened to Catherine Bentley's toddler. Did he get thrown down as well?
I do believe he was with her. Right. Yeah, it's not actually clear, but it's not clear that he was anywhere else either. So I suspect that he was with her. But I can't. I would not absolutely hang my hat on that.
Claire, did you get any impression that the throwing of Catherine from the balcony was to save her?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think to save her. Yeah. No, the man who is suggesting this, that he was involved in this, it was to save her. And there are many points at which men act gallantly towards women who are there, particularly in the Stockade massacre itself, where it's clear that the government, the troopers were. Firing on a civilian population that included women and children, and then torching all of the tents around the stockade, as you well know, that also included women and children. And some of the eyewitness accounts say, you know, there was a soldier who looked into the tent, saw that there was a woman and her little children, and left them alone. Mm-hmm. That there was a woman actually giving birth while this was going on, and the soldiers came in, saw her, and let her be, and walked away. And when these things happen, they're commented upon because there are just as many commentators remarking on the fact that they could not believe that the British government would do this. People's moral universes were turned upside down. The chronicler who tells us that a woman was killed at the stockade, one of the reasons he does that, he says it's an indelible stain on a British government because he cannot believe that they would fire on implicitly, a white population. Clearly they fired on women and children in black populations, but that they would turn the guns on a white civilian population. Absolutely confounded ideas of British governance and British civility.
I've also had it suggested to me that Catherine's Ulster Protestant background was a significant incentive for some in the crowd to hate the Bentleys.
Absolutely, and one of the things, Greg, that I've tried to do in reconstructing this society is to, in a sense, undermine the myth that Eureka was about egalitarianism. I don't think that it was about equality at all. I think equality and fairness are two different concepts. And people were there for social mobility. They quite clearly, that's what they wanted. Nobody was there to be the same as anybody else. They were there because they wanted to rise through society. And certain people who had already very successfully risen through society, like Catherine, who was, as I said at the beginning, Protestant in a largely Irish Catholic community at Eureka, who had done very well for herself when others were struggling with abject poverty, there were all sorts of tensions that were rising constantly. And one of the other, like there are a lot of very small details that I have pulled out of the sources. One of them that I found very interesting in the lists of things that the storekeepers were selling, many of whom the storekeepers were women as well, you could buy on the goldfields things like potted pheasant and smoked lobster imported from England and Havana cigars and French butter. But you could only buy those things if you'd done well. Mm. And the majority of the population had done so well that they couldn't afford to buy an egg, and they couldn't afford to bring a doctor around when their wife was dying in childbirth and had her uterus hanging outside of her body. There are some very gory details in this book because they are spoken about quite readily in the sources. Mm. And you know, there's one fellow who loses his wife in childbirth, and at the inquest, the coroner says, "So why didn't you get a doctor around?" And he said, "Because we didn't have a blessed sixpence in the tent." Mm. So on the one hand, you have people eating potted pheasant, and the other people, you have women dying in childbirth because there are massive disparities. Battlers and billionaires, Andrew.
Thank you for the plug, Ben. Very kind. Yes.
Claire, it's a long time since I've been to Ballarat, but I know that regional towns like that tend to kind of own something that's mm-hmm. happened in their area. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, and I noticed that not long, perhaps in the last decade or so, there's been new memorials put up mm-hmm. for Eureka. Mm-hmm. To what extent have the kind of keepers of the flame in Ballarat been receptive to the rebalancing that you're doing? Are they resistant or accepting?
Great question. There is no town that is more proprietorial about its story than Ballarat is mm-hmm. of Eureka. I was told when I started this research that I better get a bodyguard.
Yeah.
And I kind of scoffed at the time and thought that was a particular cynical historian who was, paternalistic historian who was telling me that. A few years later, I had to get a restraining order out on a fellow who was had been criminally stalking me for 18 months because he didn't like my interpretation of something. There is a new museum in Ballarat called the Museum of Australian Democracy at Eureka, otherwise known as MAID. And it just opened in May this year. Mm. And it was one of those very fortunate coincidences of me carrying out this research at the same time that the federal government and the state government had given $10 million towards this project, and they were basically taking what had been a white elephant, which was the Eureka Centre, and turning it into this much larger story, placing Eureka at the centre of a story about Australian democracy and international democracy. It's a very vibrant, progressive, forward-thinking, technologically whiz-bang place. And I was brought into the project about 5 years ago as a consultant and an advisor, and so I was able to feed my research through to them. So that particular display is very balanced. But even in doing that, I found that I had to keep revising, keep red-penning various, texts that was coming my way, because the traditional narrative is very strong. It's almost kind of knee-jerk, right up until the last stages where they were putting the new memorial down. There's a new memorial stone that pays tribute to the fallen, to those who lost their lives. And this particular stone has the list of all the men who died, whose names are known, and that list has been in currency pretty much since Peter Lawler made that list in 1855. It's been repeated many times. But they'd added a line to the top of it saying, we honour the people the lives lost at Eureka, and the names of the men who we don't know, whose names we know and who we don't know. Mm. And then they sent that text to me, and I said, what have we been doing for 5 years? This is your opportunity. if you don't say the names of the men and women whose names we don't know, you will be behind the scholarship in a few months' time when this book comes out. You will have had this opportunity to change the way we memorialise these things, and you will have passed it up. And to me, that isn't going to be a slip of the tongue. That's negligent. And almost determined in some way. They changed it. And so that memorial stone now says to the men and women who killed at Eureka, whose names we know and whose names we don't know. For me as an historian, that's quite a proud moment, because I think that memorials mean something, as you've suggested. Mm. I think the way that things are carved into stone and marble mean something. They are taken seriously in the way that even a 540-page book written by an academic over 10 years may not be.
It's a bit of an analogy there to potentially reworking Anzac legends too.
You can only hope.
Do you think, it's interesting thinking about Anzac and Eureka, mm-hmm. and certainly, as I understand it, Menzies regarded Eureka as being far more important than Howard did. Howard sort of
wouldn't
fly the flag on the 150th anniversary. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a sense in which the Eureka boffins will need to work hard over the next 4 years, with the centenary of World War I, to keep the flag flying?
I think Eureka is a story that will bubble along under the surface as a kind of national bedtime story that we will get told over and over again because it's taught in school. I hope it will start to be taught differently in school, and I'm very grateful that Text Publishing are going to do a young adult version of this book. So over the next year or so, we will whittle this 150,000 words down to 50,000, and it will be published because of the National History Curriculum. I think that we will start telling these stories in different ways. I think the Anzac story is going to be started to be told in different ways as well. But I think that we are probably at the peak of militarism in terms of it being our national romance with it. I think that this is my personal point of view, is that once we get out of Afghanistan, and if we are not sent into any other wars, John Howard did a fantastic job of selling Australia's involvement in those two wars. He sent us into those two wars on the back of a campaign to romanticise and elevate the Digger and Anzac to this legendary status in the Australian national character. So, how can you trash this good Aussie bloke and who is the Anzac Digger? And we went to war on that basis. And I think that when we're out, there will be revision. I think the centenary, there's going to be an absolute spike and it'll all go hyper. But I also know that because I've been involved in this process. For example, I've just written a 4-part documentary for the ABC, which will be the ABC's main contribution to World War I centenary programming. They have other documentaries, but this is their 4-part series called The War That Changed Us, about Australia's involvement in World War I. And the way that I conceptualised that and pitched it to the ABC, and which they took up, we're in production on it now, is looking at the war from the perspective of both the home front and the battlefield. On the battlefield, we look at the lives of Australians through 5 main characters. 2 are women and 3 are men, so there's some balance there, finally. 1 is an Anzac nurse, but 1 on the home front is an anti-war protester. And so we're looking at the way that Australian society was actually ripped to shreds by World War I, the conscription debates that absolutely tore at the fabric of communities, you know, neighbours who wouldn't talk to each other because they were on either sides of the conscription debate. We are going to be told more stories than I think have come out over the last 10 to 15 years, because there is a strong pushback, partly from scholarship, partly from some of these other cultural institutions who do have a responsibility these days to be more inclusive and to be more accurate. So, you know, the War Memorial still has trouble with recognising, say, the frontier wars, but they're doing a pretty good job of recognising women's involvement in World War One.
Well, we're over time, but I can't resist asking one final question, tying together the Eureka story and the suffragette movement.
Suffragettes in Australia. Suffragettes were the English ones who were bombing Parliament. They were the military touristic ones. In Australia, they were known as the suffragists, not the suffragettes.
Point well taken. I stand corrected.
You can tell me something economics-y that I've gotten wrong in the book.
Sure. We can talk relative prices later. How do you think Peter Lawler would have felt knowing that Australia's first female Prime Minister would be the member for Lawler?
Well, I don't think that Peter Lawler would have been very happy about it. He was not a progressive. I've traced the beginning of the suffrage movement back to this mass popular protest movements on the goldfields, and the documentary that I made last year made that point, and the book makes the point as well, that there were women who were advocating women's rights as part of these broader movements. But Peter Lawler was not a social progressive. And he showed his stripes pretty quickly after he was elected as a member for Parliament. He became a conservative, he became a mine owner, and he had the workers striking against him pretty quickly because he wasn't a particularly generous mine owner at that. So he lost a lot of the respect of the mining community very quickly. And I suggest he probably would have been happier with Barry Jones, but maybe not even that.
Nothing if not full of contradictions. Claire, thank you for a wonderfully stimulating conversation. Please join me in thanking you.